Welcome to the Bay Area Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Jamal Khan, and I'm going to be interviewing Ed Hernandez, who is a member of the San Leandro City Council.
You are the council member for the second district of San Leandro, is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
District 2.
District 2.
And what area of the city does that cover?
It mostly covers the south portion of San Leandro, southeast portion. And so you look at the freeways, they run. So I'm looking more towards the hills and towards where the Bayfair Mall's at, and a little bit more north from that area. But it is one of the more lower economic average medium income portion of the city. So you have renters and people who might be more housing insecure, and there's maybe more food access concerns in part of this community. And it's also part of the areas when deemed as an opportunity zone. So there are needs and sort of opportunities to sort of find ways to help people survive the current pandemic crisis with resources through the city of San Leandro.
Okay. And what roughly is the population of that district?
Well, the whole city in the whole is about 90,000 folks, and we're split up into six districts, but I think we have more multifamily or higher density housing in here. So we probably have about 15 to 20,000 people,
okay,
I would say.
And
but the whole city votes, so therefore you represent the whole city, but you have to live in one portion of the town.
I see. Is it like a voting at large system, or is it?
Yes, it is at large.
I see. Okay, so.
I think I lost.
So it looks, are you able to hear me? Oh, okay.
Yes, sir.
So it looks like candidates kind of have to campaign across the city, because it looks like anybody can in the city is able to vote.
Yes, correct. This is what I did the last election cycle.
I see. Okay. And in terms of like what percentage of the population would you say is like registered to vote?
Well, I think right now we had about, what was the stats? 90,000 people. And I think we had at least 57% of people registered this time around or so. And we had about 34,000 people come out to vote in this cycle.
I see. Okay. And what's the composition of the voting population in terms of like their party affiliation, you know, Democrat, Republican, Independent?
I would say majority is Democratic, maybe about 10% Republican.
Okay. And so what motivated you to run for office?
I think it came up about 9 years ago or so that I got appointed to the Planning Commission, given the Great Recession, my background in real estate development, and the need for housing solutions. I wanted to learn more about government. And in doing so, I had the opportunity to be appointed by the former council member Ursula Reed, whom I was able to network with through some previous council member and a staff member, offering the opportunity for me to be appointed when the seat came up. And then when she was being termed out subsequently, I thought, well, I was helping plan the future for San Leandro. Let me see if I can shape it and work towards what we planned for the additional housing, more services in the community, and you know, affecting change and finding ways to live it better than I found it. So in doing so, I was able to serve a term and being able to, you know, really push forward some housing development opportunities. I think over 2,000 homes in the pipeline, redeveloping the marina, putting some focus on setting the table for the Bayfair Transit-Oriented Development Project, which is also an opportunity zone next to one of the BART stations here in San Leandro. Unfortunately, I'm not being reelected this term, but however, I'm pretty proud of my service. I think right now it's very partisan, some of the elements of our cities. And so right now I'm just looking to be more moderate, maybe not as progressive as some people might want me to be, just trying to work with police to reform and reimagine them. And also, you know, there's challenges with people not feeling safe, insecure. But ultimately, I know that I did the work to ensure that we had and have the resources necessary to deploy food access, housing solutions, technology, tablets, and be able to provide that testing free in our community, provide resources to our homeless members, and had a lot of support from the state, local, and the county leadership. And then I'm proud of the opportunity to have served the community for at least 9 years. So now it's about, okay, now what do I do next? And I think right now I have a lot of systemic knowledge of what can be done better. Mm-hmm. And in my private capacity, really now move forward with maybe working on some projects that I see that are passion projects, like tiny homes, maybe a homeless navigation center, working with other nonprofits to drive that, because the policies that are in play, you know, setting up the city for the next 4 to 8 years, I think it's pretty solid. So I'm pretty proud of the work. And I think I just had the opportunity to do some good things, travel, work with other elected officials, as I also sit on other boards on behalf of the city, like the East Bay Community Energy that provides clean energy and green jobs. It's been fun, and I'm honored to be able to be of service.
Oh, great. No, that's you know, it's very impressive, all the, you know, different things you've been able to do and that you've been involved in. As a council member, what was your most memorable experience as a council member? You know, if it was maybe somebody you interacted with or something that you observed that really...
Well, I think this earlier this year, before the pandemic, there's concerns of a new owner of about 90 or so townhomes here in San Leandro, and they were going to be maybe evicted basically all at once. They were getting threatening letters like, I'm going to increase the rent by X, Y, or Z, and you can take a cash out option now or maybe less later. And so they reached out to me, and then I, you know, was able to go out there and working with the tenant protections we had in place. Share that these notices are pretty much invalid, and they can't really force you to take it. And it says, don't really stress out about, don't be concerned, because the city has protections in place that if they really want to relocate you, they will have to give you three times as much to really make it, you know, something that would be doable. And then the state came back also with the rent protection of capping any rents no more than, I think, 12% in a given 3 years, I believe, or so. Mm-hmm. But that also created additional protections. So having a community, a neighborhood, about 50, 60 people being really worried, concerned about where are they going to move to? I mean, their kids and families have me relocated. And one of the ladies saying, this is going to be my forever home. This is where she was going to retire. And now she was sort of worried and being able to put at the community at ease in that neighborhood. I was pretty proud of that. I mean, I know that I worked and battled with the city and this, with my councils to collaborate what sort of the right level of protections for residents and being able to sort of cap it, what we call the tenant relocation assistance program or ordinance, afforded opportunities to not have people be evicted and be unhoused, and especially with families and a lot of immigrants and folks of people of color there. And given that my family immigrated from Mexico when I was born in Los Angeles, but my mother came over pregnant, mm-hmm. and they're now citizens, I could only imagine how stressful that'd be. It was and is for these folks and for my parents to have sort of maybe be appended. And I just worry about people and kids specifically having to move from place to place, not having a stable opportunity to grow, make friends, and really learn. So that's why I'm passionate about housing. And people might not have liked that I was for some housing projects in San Leandro, and they wanted more time to discuss it with the developer, but that's what kills projects, mm-hmm. development opportunities, time. And yeah, maybe I didn't do what was right to get reelected, but I did what was right for the community. And at least half of the community or so saw it that way. And like I said, I'm not here to have been reelected, but I'm here to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No, that's really very inspiring. And I would say in terms of what single accomplishment are you most proud of?
Well, I mean, one of my former council members also asked me that, and what would be one of the highest accomplishments. And it's not the very sexy thing you think about, but helping the city amass a general fund reserve of $52 million, which we're drawing upon on at least $6 to $12 million this year to provide those critical services, maintaining those services, and being able to keep the lights on and not having to sort of furlough or fire anybody doing critical work for the city of San Leandro. And that was because of 3 years ago, I pushed forward sort of the visibility to understand, okay, what happens when the next recession comes? Are we ready for it? What does it look like? So that way we can provide those vital services, provide food access, housing, rental relief, legal assistance, and maintaining public safety, especially when we had civil unrest, looting in San Leandro because of an officer-involved shooting that occurred almost 7 months ago and beyond the incidents with George Floyd. So we were pretty much in the center of it, the hurricane. And yeah, maybe I'll be a casualty of one of the this past year, but it's okay. I mean, we do our best and we learn from our failures. I don't like to say it's a failure, but it's more of an opportunity to be better and do better and maybe just learn. Ultimately, I think that's sort of the important thing is that you were ready to weather the storm. A lot of people in my community respected, understood that, but not everybody agreed. Ultimately, I'm proud of the work, and I think that's one of the things that prepared us to weather the storm and never knowing what the storm would look like, why would it come, but the fact that we're ready for it, I think that's really what's important, and people understand that value that was there necessary to prepare for it.
Great. And I know that given your background in real estate management, were there any skills or experiences that you picked up that were helpful to you later on when you entered public service?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is understanding the challenges and providing housing solutions, what it entails to develop property, the efforts to ultimately attract capital and investment, making sure it's somewhere, a place people want to be and invest, but also focusing on the community about bringing the right level of balance and that dynamic of change. And so not only real estate management, but also change management is what I have a background in, and understanding how can you make people feel safe and comfortable to go through this journey with you when they might be a little scary. And so then you have to build forth that confidence or that safety net that it'll be fine. Things change is constant. This ultimately is better for the community. Not everybody will always agree. And with public service, you have to sort of find a way to help as many people agree. In private, you don't necessarily need to have everybody agree. You just sort of push that person out of a, they call it the canoe theory. If you're going down the river in the canoe and you're putting your oar in, you ask people to sort of paddle at the right speed, same speed. But if you don't, you either pull over and let them get out and find their canoe. If not, you push them out. So you can't really necessarily do that with the community because ultimately the elected official is the one getting pushed out, like in my case. So ultimately, I just have to find my next canoe work to sort of understand what are the dynamics of this situation, what do people like or not like about things, and try to find the interests versus the positions that people might hold. But sometimes people want to stick to their positions, and that's fine. I have to find a way to, you know, be what's best for the community at whole. And there's a lot of challenges where not everybody's going to agree, but what can we do to make it better for the entire community or that segment of the population to accept the change and try to work with them and figure out how we can collaborate and sometimes compromise when time is limited. So I think that's part of it, just trying to manage change, the elements and the dynamics of what's being put in front of you and figure out, is there sort of a root cause? Or is this a symptom of a bigger problem? Like we were talking last night around 11 o'clock about panhandling, excuse me, and the safety of folks on those mediums and then, you know, protection of free speech. Because if people want to be in the middle of a medium with a sign, they can. I think there was some legislation or some cases that occurred that said that's a protection of free speech. But the idea of safety came up. That it's not really safe to be on those mediums. But then again, who is going to be on that medium? Most likely vulnerable populations that you want to protect and not incarcerate. And finding ways to help people who maybe are struggling to meet ends and at most make $300 a month doing that. Well, can we find better ways to help them if they want to be helped? So you look at that and you try to bring forth, you know, and when you say real estate management, the whole city is just a real estate play. It depends how you sort of manage those assets and ensure that the people who live here that want to stay here that when they work here, you will create the environment that people can thrive to live, work, or play in the community that should be and ought to be maybe something available for everyone.
What are the advantages of making decisions at the municipal level, you know, compared to other levels like the state level or the county level?
Well, the farther you get away from the local level, the more abstract it becomes, I believe, and the less you are really connected to your neighbors at that level. So that's why it's important to collaborate with county, state, and federal officials to share the stories. Is that the...
All right, so it's having a stronger connection to the local community rather than being kind of more distant.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily being distant, but they have so many more stakeholders and they only have so much time to really understand the issues or concerns. So then you have to be the microphone or the aggregator of data or insights to why these matter, these issues matter. And that's the only way you effective governance, when you have strong local leaders advocating for their community with their county, state, and federal legislators to drive policy changes that really affect the community in the ways you want them to, like the CARES Act. You know, you're asking for money to support the communities, but then the federal government comes out with, oh, it's only going to be deployed to cities greater than 500,000 people. Like, well, what about the cities that are less than that? How do we get those resources? And you have the relationships to get those resources so that we can provide those, you know, the community markets to people who cannot shop for food, but at the regular grocery store, but can go to the food pantry and pick up some items there. And then you understand how important it is to get that, those resources to them.
Right. Absolutely. And was there any vote that came up where it was like tough for you to sort of, you know, take a side or the other, or you had to really weigh the options and where it was kind of, you know, not so clearly black and white, but there was a lot of gray?
Well, I think early on into my elected role, we had to discuss the sanctuary city policies and then the threat of losing federal funds for the city and being finding a way to have to make up those funds and say it was maybe, I don't know, $10 million or something like that and figure out, okay, so I'm going to lose this money, or at least it's threatened to lose this money. And but do you take the position of taking on the sanctuary city policy? And I think ultimately you do. And I did support the sanctuary city policy because if people don't feel safe, community, regardless how many people it is, I think it's important to help them feel safe and protected so that way people can go to work, the kids feel safe to go to school, and ultimately they're producing and buying and shopping different things for community to maintain sort of that vibrancy that your city needs, not only just from their activities, but also, you know, spending money on different resources and the city's been able to collect taxes and then be able to support those services. So yeah, maybe we'll be short, but that's why you have reserves. And ultimately, there was also a case saying that's not possible. They can't hold back those federal funds because it was already disputed before in the previous administration that they wouldn't be able to hold them back. But she still didn't know what could happen or not. But ultimately, it was better to err on the side of, like, you know, people who might be suffering from domestic violence, they may not call the police, especially if they have no immigration, you know, they're maybe illegal alien, say that, or undocumented. So was that something that good that we want to support? So then looking at those issues and sort of extrapolating examples, stories, or challenges, concerns are quite important to sort of figure out what's better for the community. And I think better was to help people be safe and protected rather than looking at the financial potential losses and, yeah, finding another way to make up for them if necessary.
Your council member page mentions the Association of Bay Area Government General Assembly. What exactly is that organization?
Yeah, when I was first elected, that's one of the first appointments that I was asked to do. So the Association of Bay Area Governments is mostly the voice for the city at the county level, at the various Bay Area county. So the nine Bay Area counties, you have different representatives that gather, that move policy forward, initiatives and support different needs of the community. So that's sort of the voice, sort of a mini Congress, let's say, for the cities to choose and move forward on items of interest, policy changes, sometimes focused on transportation issues. And then they move forward those policies. I wasn't involved as much because of the time commitment. And funny enough, people think that this council member job is your full-time job. You don't really get paid too much, on average $7 an hour. So I do have a full-time job. So those were being done in the middle of the day. It's like, I can't really attend those. I mean, they didn't have Zoom then. So now you could. But a lot of times there were those face-to-face meetings in San Francisco. I'm like, oh, this is pretty tough. But ultimately, I transitioned to other agencies like Alameda County Fire Department, Needles Abatement, and now East Bay Community Energy. But the ABAG focuses on the assembly and management of voices for folks in the community of elected leaders.
I know you've mentioned that food access, food insecurity is a major issue in San Leandro. And I know that there are some federal programs like the community eligibility provision, the school lunch program, the summer food service program that can be helpful, I think, for some kids who are facing food insecurity. Sure. What is the role of municipal officials in sort of helping to guide residents in being able to benefit from those programs?
I mean, the programs are set to work with local nonprofits who will tap into those resources and or the city administrators, community development block grants to allocate funds to organizations that are providing basic food access and basic needs. And then the city or the government, local government, might be able to add on and provide additional grants like we did in this past year. Over $1 million of additional resources were deployed to local nonprofits, to rental relief. But you also have the schools that have their own funding that they're able to then also then provide that lunch program, which then schools being closed, I was out there passing out some bags of foods for families and their kids. So that way they would have the necessary nutritious meals that were afforded. But since school was closed, there was, at first no way to pick them up. But then they started providing those box meals to pick up the foods for, that 3-day lunch supply and what have you. And I think all meals for the day. But really, our job is to deploy any kind of resources we get from the federal, state, or county over to providers who can execute that. And then a lot of times you have the Alameda County Food Bank that, acquires the food. And then the local food pantries are able to create those community markets where people can pick up groceries on a weekly basis. And then you work with them to make sure they have the resources. And if not, we grant them additional resources from our own general funds. And extra demand like we have now, extra demand for food access.
Okay. And you've mentioned, your work in trying to sort of expedite your development of new housing. What would you say are the major, bottlenecks or roadblocks that that can prevent or delay the construction of new housing?
Well, I think either there's community concerns, there's lawsuits, there's challenges with the California Environmental Quality Act or CEQA. There have other agencies that need to have sign off and approval. Like we have a shoreline development project that recently just got approved. I was in high school in 1992 when this project kicked off. Now we're looking at 2020, and I think we're going to do some groundbreaking next year, finally, because you have agencies like the Bay Conservation Development Corporation that focused on saying, hey, you need to be ready for the 50-year flood, or every 1 in 50 years, you'll have this high tide. It comes in. Now they say, well, you can actually need to be every 100-year flood, which means you need to build it at a higher threshold. So that delayed the project a couple more years because now they're being asked to raise the dirt or the pad 3 feet. So you need to bring in dirt. Demands, challenges that delay projects, but sometimes it's maybe for the best. You work with different folks to understand, to work with even unions who might also have concerns about having a project labor agreement, so that way it's a a jobs that benefit people who live in the area, and that have maybe they call prevailing wages, or sort of living wages, so that way they're getting paid well versus just folks who are non-union, and then there is no community benefit overall, because people who are maybe in the trades live in the area where those jobs are going to be created, and the idea is that not only will they be able to benefit from the local jobs, but also there'll be protections from against stoppages, and you're sort of building that ecosystem of apprenticeship programs to help talent grow here locally to do the jobs. So those are some things that could be challenges on any kind of project. And then also the quest for more affordable units. It's hard when you have some landowners who maybe want to sell the property for what they think it's worth, and negotiating that. And you work with community groups who might say, well, if you vote this way, I'm going to vote you out. I'm like, well, I guess you can. In some cases, you do, and possibly like mine. But ultimately, like I said, the projects are needed, the housing is needed. People are having to pay more than 50% in rent, when sort of the standard's been about 35% of their average income, and it's getting worse, more about 57%. And then some people are having to rent out a bathtub to sleep in the bathroom, because that's the only place they can afford. So you start hearing those stories, like, and then you think about the kids who are living in those environments, are just sort of stacked on stacked on stacked. And then how is that quality of life? How do you have your own space? You don't. And so it just becomes more concerns of mental challenges. And you have people who might have other challenges and might not have a shared reality. And you start thinking about that snowball. And so how can you unwind that before you have a tragic incident like we had in San Leandro, where somebody was involved in officers involved shooting, and the gentleman ended up dying from that because he was not having that shared reality moment. And that involves in lawsuits and stress and trauma, not only on that person's family who died at the hands of the officer, but also the officer who's now being charged with voluntary manslaughter, because the question is, was it necessary for him to shoot the gun? And some people will argue that yes or no, and they put us in the position that we have to sort of support or not. But ultimately, it's in the hands of a jury now, and that's something that has to be decided. But the reality is, was there more resources for this person available? Probably not. Should there have been? Yeah. So there's a tragic instance of somebody dying in the hands of a police officer when maybe that shouldn't have happened, and they had maybe helped them a few times, but probably there weren't enough resources at the time. So there's systemic failures that are need to be addressed.
Right. I just remember, President Obama has a book that just came out today, I think, A Promised Land, and he talks about how, a lot oftentimes police officers are being asked to put a lid on communities that have had long-running, more fundamental issues with poverty and with lack of resources, and it's a lot of the issues are these are much underlying issues that are going to require a lot of attention to really fully address.
Yeah, and the lid's blown off. And so that's why you're seeing more of the movement in this moment for Black Lives Matter, for people of color, for indigenous individuals as well. So the BIPOC community. So just trying to bring more shared equity and racial inclusion, because so much time has passed that there's been, sort of these challenges that goes back to the what they call the Black Wall Street, when people of color or African American were being successful, and then the Caucasian or white folks were not interested in seeing that. And then you have these policies that are in place systemically biased and racist, and you have to find ways to identify how you police your policies and who you recruit to do those policies. Instead of recruiting individuals who are just returning back from war, you have that warrior mentality. You have to bring somebody who might be more balanced into trying to be more compassionate, being able to solve community concerns and being more of a community liaison instead of just the enforcer. So I think that's a shift you're going to see more. And so that's what I was committed to, being part of working with our police unions. And the Democratic Party at this moment didn't want any kind of potential candidates to work with them or reject endorsements. And I didn't see it that way. I can't see myself building walls when I need to be building bridges. So if that's just me not being progressive, that's just me. But I'm a change agent. I need to know how I can bring the sides together that might not agree on everything, but that's sort of how I saw my role. And I think now the police has more of a burden to do it on their own, more so, and learn how to change. And I think right now we've asked our police departments to do too much for us, and that's the systemic failure there too, because they're the ones answering the phones, because they're the ones there, and they're not necessarily always the right people to be the marriage counselor, the dog catcher, and be able to person to pull you over for a ticket and be concerned for their life, because you don't know if they have a gun or not. And there's more and more guns popping up in some of the violent incidents. So that's a concern that's going on.
Yeah, that's, you know, these are very you know, tough issues to kind of sort through. And it's I think when you, when I know you first ran for city council in 2016, were there any major changes between 2016 and 2020 that made you have to campaign differently?
Yeah, my family got hit by COVID. So I had to be more remote for 25 days. Yeah, they've recovered, but it's a very scary time. So I was able out there door knocking, as maybe more people get used to. And my volunteers would not door knock either, because for their own safety, they didn't want to have conversations with people. They felt safer just to drop collateral, which I had some of the best collateral in the world. But you're not having those conversations. It's very hard to sort of stand out, regardless of what you've done for the community. You're not able to have that one-on-one dialogue to sort of educate or inform people of why you deserve another 4 years. So the other candidate was able to go out there. He started running 2 years ago. I'm like, well, it's not the right time. And so the right time is normally from election, from Labor Day to Election Day, sort of the core period. And I just hit right in the middle. So I was sidelined. And so that's unfortunate. Before, I was walking every day right after work until about 8:30 or so, until I felt that was not, you know, probably appropriate to knock on doors at people's homes. You know, so that sort of, you know, and then by then I didn't have the institutional support that I had now, and sort of just flipped on me because of this environment. Like I said, a bit upside down, and I might be back in a couple of years. I'll have maybe an opportunity to run for mayor if I choose to do so. But right now I think I have to take some time, refocus on my family, and see if that's what I want to do. You know, it's sort of a big lift, because you have to build a big machine, raise over 60 to 80 grand just for a local election. You're asking a lot of friends and family, a lot of the business interests as well. And then somewhat you're demonized for taking developer money, when at the same time, it's somebody who's investing in the community and feels you're a good fit to lead the city forward.
In terms of, in addition to, you know, knocking on doors, you know, until 8:30, did you also do other kind of things, like, you know, making phone calls, sending out mailers, or using social media?
Yeah, of course. So I had a mailer. I did a League of Women Voters forum, conversations with neighbors, got as many endorsements as I could. The basics was a lot of door knocking, fundraising, collateral, phone calls, some endorsements, and, you know, being involved in nonprofits, local organizations, and being present and having a solid statement that my financial background, my master's in business and organizational development poised me to really shape something in his future, given that I have been on the planning commission for 5 years planning his future. And with that message, I was consistent, focused, and ready to lead the city in preparing it for the next recession, and which I did.
Okay, great. And so what advice would you give to a young person who is interested in government and public service?
You always want to have a strong why. Why do you want to do this? It's not easy. When you get into public life, your life is not your life anymore. Your life is that of a public servant. You're there for the people, which means if you have family, other things that you want to do more of, there's going to be less time of that. You will be at meetings or now calls to 3 a.m, working through issues, listening to public comment that may love you, may hate you, may have concerns that will stretch how you think about certain things. You have to be ready for that, but you will not be ready for that. You will be ready to make some effect, some change. The question is that going to really drive enough of what you want to do to make a difference? If the answer is yes, then you reach out to people who are in positions of power. You're mentored, you're sponsored into opportunities to, you know, give advice, share thoughts, help move some policies or actions forward on behalf of people who you believe in, who you believe are doing the right things, who are driving the change you want to see in your community. And the question is, how can you be involved? Well, you do a lot of research, you learn, you get involved in nonprofits, you learn about shaping policy, what is policy, and you try to maybe get appointed to some role, and you sort of keep at it. Because if you have a goal, well, it's the difference between a good idea and an idea that works is the work. So you do the work, and ideally you get the goal. And ultimately, it's about your passion and why you want to suffer for this. But ultimately, if you see it's a calling, it's something you really want to do, then you go after it. If it makes it happy, then awesome, because there are benefits. You get to meet interesting places, go interesting places, and meet those interesting people and build those relationships. Because when I was asked and was looking to consider joining the Marines, they said you sort of did the same thing, but just went ahead and killed people at the end of it. Like, well, I don't want to do that. I want to make people better. And so that's what I'm trying to do. And leave it better than I found it for my daughters, for my family. I'm the oldest of a family of immigrants. My parents both came from large families. And I wanted to be a good role model. And I think that's sort of what I've done. And I'll continue doing. We'll see what's next for me.
Okay, excellent. No, that's very inspiring. And I think that's something that a lot of people can get some guidance from. And so that's pretty much all the questions I have. Right. Are there any final comments you'd like to make?
No, I mean, other than we're in this pandemic, it's worse than ever. But I think ultimately people stay safe, stay socially distant, stay home in some cases. I think we'll get through it. Just patience. I know we don't have a lot of it sometimes, but that's what's important. And the actual, when you're in it, like my family was, it's scary, stressful. And it's important to not go through that trauma, because it does impact the way you see things. And it's better to not take that risk, because you really don't know how this is going to affect you personally. And it affects people differently. But ultimately, it's important to get through this. As I think Winston Churchill said, when you are going through hell, keep going. And I think that's the message I would share.
Thank you for listening to the Bay Area Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Jamal Khan. Don't forget to subscribe and tell all your friends and family about the podcast. You can find out more about me at www.jamalkhan.org. Take care.